Tonight on the Daily Debrief, testimony about police tactics in the case of a plainclothes officer who shot and killed a stranded black motorist. And New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft enters his plea on sex charges. Also, new details in the underage sex case against a teacher. Plus, was this defendant's cell phone near the graves of his business partner and his family? Did he do it? The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Friday, March 1st. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Aaron Keller, along with Imran Ansari. Good to see you again.
See you.
All right, let's get straight to it. Day three of testimony in the trial of a Florida police officer who faces an attempted murder charge for shooting and killing a stranded African-American motorist. Newman Raja also faces a charge of manslaughter regarding the 2015 shooting death of Corey Jones. Jones was stranded on the side of an interstate exit ramp. Raja shot him and claims self-defense. One critical piece of evidence in this case is a police recording of the defendant just hours after the shooting. This is Newman Raja himself describing the events. Pay very close attention to the defendant in his own words here. He claims he identified himself as a police officer when he confronted the victim.
As I got close to the vehicle and the door swung open and this guy jumps out and I immediately got out of the van and he's like, I'm okay, man. And at which point I said, hey man, police, can I help you? And second I said police, he jumped back and I clearly remember him drawing and pointing a gun at me. I saw that silver muzzle and he had, I can swear on this, he had a Laser Max laser in the guide rod in the gun. And I saw that red light of that Laser Max flashing at me. And I immediately just shouted, drop the gun, and sorry.
Take a deep breath. Let's do this, okay? Do you need a drink?
No.
Listen, I want you to take your time.
He seemed very certain of himself there when he was describing what happened. Roger was driving in an unmarked van. It did not have a logo. It did not have flashing lights. He was not wearing a uniform, though he was wearing one earlier in his shift. Still, he claims he identified himself as an officer. What he might not have been counting on was this roadside recording of the victim calling roadside assist before Officer Raja approached. Nowhere in this call can Raja be heard identifying himself as a police officer. Here is the recording along with an FBI transcript. The first sound you will hear are the electronic chimes generated by Corey Jones leaving his car door open.
Stop. I'm good. Y'all good? Yeah.
Get your fucking hands up! Get your fucking hands up! Go!
Oh my God. There's gunshots.
It's very clear the state is trying to cast former Officer Raja as a liar. Yesterday, a crime scene investigator testified that he was unable to recreate the flickering red light which Raja claimed was on the victim's gun. Raja apparently thought it was a laser sight, as you heard. The only thing authorities could actually recreate, though, was a possible reflection from a red traffic light.
That appear to be a Laser Max laser to you?
It did not appear to be. That gun has an enclosed guide rod anyway. That gun wouldn't be compatible with the Laser Max laser. We tried to get the red reflectivity and the flicker pattern. We got the red. We tried from several different angles and we couldn't get the same flicker pattern or any flicker pattern. I was able to get I was able to view it with my eyes and I was actually able to capture it with the camera, with the red traffic signal reflecting off the front of the pistol.
This trial has raised serious questions about whether Officer Raja's tactics were proper or improper.
Defense attorney asked you if it was paramount to the safety of the officer at times to get out of his vehicle if he's approached by a dangerous situation.
Absolutely.
Is it also paramount to the safety of an officer to approach a vehicle as if you're conducting a traffic stop?
It can be, yes.
Is it paramount to the safety of an officer to actually get behind a vehicle when conducting a traffic stop for the safety of the officer?
It Can be, yes.
Is it paramount to the safety of the officer to make sure that they are clearly identifiable to a person that they're conducting a traffic stop on?
Yes.
This was not an undercover operation, was it?
It was not.
It was not the purpose of the defendant to act as if he was undercover, was it?
Sustained. Rephrase.
Was it the purpose of this defendant to act as if he was undercover?
No.
Was the purpose to be clearly identifiable as a law enforcement officer if necessary?
Yes.
And the instructions, were they to put his vest on when he was exiting the vehicle to make contact? Is that the instruction?
To be readily identifiable.
And if he exited his vehicle to make contact with anybody, was he supposed to be readily identifiable?
Yes.
And is that not only for the safety of him?
Sustained.
Is that for the safety of him, sir?
Yes.
Is it also for the safety of anybody that he would come into contact with?
Yes.
You previously testified that there is no way that somebody would be able to tell if that unmarked white van was a law enforcement vehicle. Correct?
Yes.
This same sergeant testified that officers are trained to react to changing circumstances.
Defense attorney asked you if there are times where something may suddenly change that will cause a law enforcement officer to act. Do you remember him asking you that?
I do.
And what was your response?
Yes.
And are those sudden changes at times because a citizen or a suspect might do something to an officer?
Yes.
Are there also times where things will suddenly change because of what the officer specifically does?
At times, yes.
Arguments in court between the prosecution and the defense have also involved questions around whether the victim could have run a certain distance after he was shot. Here, the defense accuses the state of conjuring up junk science, which other experts cannot back up.
The literature and the anecdotal evidence is 100% clear on the issue. The answer is yes. Easily could have run 40 yards, 50 yards, 60 yards, 6-7 city blocks, up 4 flights of stairs, down 4 flights of stairs, because the issue is oxygen to the brain and not damage to the heart. I would venture to say there isn't another medical examiner in the country, probably in the world, competent medical examiner that would say what Dr. Joost says. I would venture to say that there isn't another medical examiner anywhere that would say that because it's junk science. And we requested a FRI hearing and you denied it without a hearing. So this isn't one of those issues where it's, well, you got one and they got one, or you got two and they got two. They couldn't get two. As a matter of fact, we have 4. We're only seeking to introduce 3. I could have gotten 20, I could have gotten 30, I could have gotten 40, because what she's saying is not what is not science. The literature, the books, their anecdotal information is crystal clear, and it's 100% on our side. There is that much time stored in the brain for the person to run at a minimum of 10 to 15 seconds. So you know how far you can, a person of average speed or walking could get in 15 seconds.
Wow, 40 experts, that's a big claim there. The defense even questioned whether the state was hiding other attempts to get experts on board the state side to bolster what the state did find. The prosecution was not happy about that alleged Brady violation. Brady, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court case, which requires prosecutors to turn evidence over to the defense.
I take exception to any kind of reference in regards to a Brady violation.
I had a feeling you were.
I think that is absolutely unnecessary and really goes against everything that we've done so far in this case, as far as the manner in which we've been treating each other. Likewise, I'm happy that counsel's statements are not evidence. because what was just said from that podium is not crystal clear. It's crystal clear depending upon the injury to the heart and depending upon what caused the injury to the heart and depending upon how that affects the blood flow, including to the brain, as to what a body will be able to do after that injury. Hence, why we have experts. I'm not a medical forensic pathologist expert, and I guarantee you, defense counsel is not. So we have experts that come here and say it. Just because I could sit here and try to slam everything that he said in a way and disparage it, but it's not evidence. That's not what we're talking about. Defense counsel wants to argue basically the Frye motion. That's done. We're here to talk about bolstering and cumulative evidence.
Well, I've ruled on Frye hearing. I've ruled on improper bolstering.
And so we're talking about cumulative evidence.
Correct.
You want to slam the state for reaching out to get other opinions? We do our job. We do a thorough investigation. I guarantee you that if we did not reach out, we'd be hearing about that right now, too.
Joining me tonight is attorney Imran Ansari on the debrief. So, okay, we've got competing experts here about just how far the victim would have been able to run after he was shot. Who wins this dispute?
Well, I think ultimately both sides got one expert each opine on each respected theory on how far Jones could have run after being shot. But you heard that that defense used the word Brady, and that, you know, the prosecution took great exception to that term because, you know, the Brady violation, using Brady against the prosecutor, that's the ultimate sort of insult to suggest that the prosecution has withheld something which falls under Brady material.
Yeah, but hey, look, the defense is going to use that kind of language because if the defense doesn't, then the defense hasn't preserved a key issue for appeal. So the defense is going to inject it in there, and of course the prosecutor is going to defend himself. The body language from the judge there was interesting, though. The judge seemed to want nothing to do with the defense argument, seemed very chipper when the prosecution was making its argument.
Right, right. And, you know, you could, when a judge's body language on the bench, you know, you could really get a good idea on how he or she is going to rule. Here you saw the defense sort of, was tired, heard the defense argument perhaps before during that Frye argument on paper. But then when the prosecution was making their record, he seemed more alert.
Certainly, okay, and you never want those icy glares from the judge. When you get those, you're probably losing. Or if the judge looks bored, then you're probably winning. Very quickly here, Sergeant Garcia seemed to agree that Raj's police tactics were wrong. That seemed to come out from a fellow officer up there, and that's key.
Yeah, the prosecution is really going to be painting a picture that Raja went against police protocol in many different ways. Didn't identify himself readily with a badge, with a uniform. And, you know, that's going to go to the prosecution's theory of the case.
Exactly. Imran Ansari, we'll check in again with you in a couple of minutes. Turning now to upcoming coverage here on the Law and Crime Network. Jason Carter of Iowa is charged with murdering his mother, Shirley Carter, back in 2015. This case has a backward procedural history. The defendant's father sued the defendant in civil court after Shirley Carter's death. A jury found Jason liable for his mother's death and awarded the father $10 million. Prosecutors stepped in after that and filed criminal charges, citing evidence from the civil trial. Normally, it's the criminal case first and then the civil case. That's why we say this one's a bit backward. Jury selection begins on Tuesday in that dispute. And now to Brian Ross for a look at what's ahead on Brian Ross Investigates.
Thanks, Aaron. This week on our program, Gone Girl, the Alabama college student who sneaked away to Syria and became an ISIS bride. Now she says she wants to come home with her toddler son, regretting that she ever called for Americans to be murdered.
I know I ruined my future and my son's future, and I'm deeply, deeply regretting.
Plus, our shout out for the reporters who uncovered children dying at three times the normal rates at a heart surgery unit run by one of the country's most prestigious medical institutions. All coming up tonight at 5:30 on Brian Ross Investigates. Aaron?
Ryan, we'll see you then. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, an Arizona school teacher who says she did not have a sexual affair with a student makes headlines yet again for more salacious accusations. Plus, Robert Kraft on your screen right now, the New England Patriots owner, enters his plea on charges of soliciting prostitution. A look inside the strategy of his legal team after the break. Time now for a check of legal incidents making headlines across the country tonight. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft has pleaded not guilty to charges in Florida that he solicited prostitution. Kraft issued that plea through his attorneys, and he's asking for a trial by judge, not by jury. Police say they observed Kraft entering and exiting a massage parlor where inside he traded money for sexual touches. Authorities say they have surveillance footage from inside the parlor as evidence. They installed hidden cameras there pursuant to a warrant. Killer Colorado dad Chris Watts has reportedly revealed more information about the brutal deaths of his wife and children. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation says Watts told authorities earlier this month more lurid details about Shannon, Bella, Celeste, and his unborn baby Nico's deaths. Full details of the killer dad story are set to be released publicly late next week. Watts pleaded guilty in November to first-degree murder charges and was sentenced to several consecutive life sentences. Troubled teacher Brittany Zamora is making headlines again for involving a second teen in her alleged underage sex romp. Zamora is now accused of telling a male student to stand watch as she had sexual contact with the 13-year-old student with whom she reportedly had an ongoing relationship. The lookout told police he thought it was weird how a 27-year-old can love a 13-year-old and said he thinks Zamora is, quote, not a good person by any stretch. Zamora and her 13-year-old victim are accused of sexually touching one another in the back of her classroom while oblivious students watched a video. Zamora pleaded not guilty but reportedly surrendered her teaching certificate last December. Back to court tonight for another trial we're following here on Law and Crime. This one is out of California. Chase Merritt is accused of murdering his business partner, Joseph McStay, and McStay's entire family. The prosecution says the motive was money. The family disappeared in 2010. A dirt biker found the bodies of all four of the McStays buried in the desert in 2013. The same detective testified about how the jailhouse phone recording system works where Merritt was incarcerated and how the system is sometimes gamed.
Every time you pick up a phone for a visit or a call, there's an automated recording that says the calls are being recorded and they're subject to monitoring.
When inmates attempt to circumvent that system, I think you mentioned one was using of their PIN number.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Can you explain that?
Objection relevance.
It's foundational, Your Honor.
The way the Securus system, which is the system that records the calls, is set up, you have to enter your booking number, which is unique to each inmate in the jail facility. So that's how the calls are tracked. That's how they can be monitored.
And is it common... somewhat common for inmates to use other inmates' PIN numbers to avoid it being logged under their PIN number?
Yes.
Would that be the reason for the steps you took to attempt to record the way you did this visit?
Yeah, there's multiple ways that we will try to figure out how, because we know visits are happening, if they're being recorded and how the system is being circumvented.
Cross-examination from that same detective about the defendant's attempts to communicate with a jailhouse visitor without using that in-house phone system, which is a recorded line. Authorities tried to record the conversations anyway. This testimony was bumpy, just like most of the rest of this case.
In Mr. Merritt's case, there's many conversations where they specifically, when I say they, I mean him and Michelle specifically is who he normally talks to, but he talks to multiple family members. They talk about, hey, we can't say this on the phone. And then they have the visits, and they don't use the phone because they know it's being recorded. So it's a conscious effort to circumvent the recording system.
Objection, speculation.
The last portion of the answer is strictly objection, sustained as false. for speculation and conclusion.
Was there more to your answer besides that?
Yes, sir.
Please continue.
So it appears to be an effort to circumvent...
Objection, speculation.
Okay, abstain.
Sorry.
So they're talking through the glass, so it's not recorded.
You can say what he did or didn't do,
okay.
But you can't offer your opinion as to why he was doing it.
I apologize. Okay, so they are not using the phone, and they are talking through the glass as opposed to talking on the phone.
Here again tonight is attorney Imran Ansari. So Imran, look, one issue that's popped up in this case is what's going on with the defendant's phone. There was testimony late yesterday that police were confused about whether the defendant's cell phone data included embedded GPS coordinates or whether it didn't. And there was a big back and forth about that. So what is going on here? Did they have a clean case or are they guessing?
Aaron, you and I know this case has problems for the prosecution. There's problems with the investigation. There's a lapse of time from when they treated it as a missing persons case to a homicide case. I think that's a factor involved here. There's sort of inconsistencies with the evidence. There was this quote-unquote, you know, blood splatter on a table, but that was never confirmed or never tested. There's the other possible suspect, Dan Kavanaugh. There's problems with the case for the prosecution, and I think this is another point that the prosecution is going to be having problems with.
Okay, so as a defense attorney, you want to needle into that. You want to be able to get up there and say things like this, which the defense tried to say. Say, wait a minute, lead investigator. You're trying to tell me that this defendant shut his phone off to purposely avoid detection while he was committing the murders, but he left it on and was even making calls when you think he was burying the bodies? And the prosecution objects to questions like that, and then the judge shuts the defense down. How is the defense supposed to present a case with that kind of a hurdle?
Well, you know, if they're laying the foundation with objections, I'm talking about appellate foundation, and they're objecting, and I think we've seen this through the defense throughout this trial, they have been laying their foundations for an appeal by preserving objections. And if the judge is not giving them a fair shot, not allowing them to put forth the defense that they're going to that they're seeking to do, well, if they have the right objections, then it's going to be tossed on appeal.
Exactly. One of the best pieces of advice I ever received from the judge for whom I clerked when I was in law school was give the prosecutor a short leash and the defense a long leash. And this is exactly why. A defendant needs a fair shot at trial. Imran Ansari, great to see you again here on the
Debrief.
All right, that's going to wrap us up for the week here. Thanks a lot for watching. I'll be back Monday at 5 o'clock Eastern right here on the Debrief. Live trial coverage picks up Monday morning at 9 a.m. Have a good weekend.